From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today we'll hear from a Republican congressman who says repealing and replacing banking regulations will help local banks. Another expert says, nah, that's not right.
It's not a community banking bill. It's a bill that really helps the largest banks escape tough new regulation.
A judge says changes in how indigent people are defended is supported by the left and the right.
If you look at the political spectrum, both on the right and the left, people believe that the constitutional rights need to be protected. People believe in the right to a fair trial.
The Trump administration is dumping members of a science review board which advises the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We'll talk to one of them.
These science advisory boards are advising on scientific research, and we have no connection to the regulatory operations of the agency.
But first, here's a news update for you. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The Trump administration has dismissed some of the scientists who perform scientific review for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Robert Richardson was a member of the Board of Scientific Counselors. He's one of 18 scientists across the country, and he now joins us via Skype. Robert, what does this board do for the EPA?
Thank you. Yes, the Board of Scientific Counselors is chartered to review scientific outputs from EPA scientists within the Office of Research and Development. So these scientific research outputs might be peer-reviewed journal articles, research posters, or decision support tools. When our committees get together, scientists give us presentations, and we give feedback and ask questions and as part of our review of those scientific outputs. In addition, we give specific recommendations to the Office of Research and Development about future directions for its strategic research action plans, which guide its scientific research.
Do we yet know how many members of the Board of Scientific Counselors of the 18 have been dismissed?
No.
The New York Times is reporting at least five. How aware were you and your fellow board members that you were to be dismissed?
We were not aware at all. We met as an executive committee in January and were given indication that for those of us for whom our first three-year term would be expiring soon, that they were already preparing paperwork to be submitted to request that our appointments be renewed for a second three-year term, which is customary. So this was all in the process, and out of total unexpected surprise on Friday evening, I received an email indicating that although my first three-year term was coming to an end and although paperwork had been submitted to extend or renew my appointment on a pro forma basis for a second three-year term, the agency has decided not to renew that appointment.
I understand that you had several tweets, maybe a little controversial, about the March for Science. Do you think this removal from the board might be political retribution?
I don't think so. I did participate in the March for Science and have tweeted about this, but I only posted a tweet about my dismissal from the board after I received the news. So the decision had been made before I posted the tweet that had gotten the attention over the weekend.
The administrator for the EPA, Scott Pruitt, and President Trump want more voices from the corporate side. What's the likelihood you're being removed to make room for someone from the corporate world?
I've seen quotes that alluded to that effect, that they believe that these boards should have industry representation. Both the Scientific Advisory Board and the Board of Scientific Counselors has a diverse membership, including university scientists, but also representatives of non-governmental organizations, the civil society, industry, and municipalities and other cities.
How do you think this will affect the decision-making process of the Board of Scientific Counselors, the removal of at least five of the board members?
I couldn't comment on that. The news is still very recent, just 3 days ago. I don't have a sense of how this will affect the operations of the board.
To your mind, what does it say about the direction of the Trump administration?
Well, certainly it would seem that, as they have stated, that they are interested in breaking with the previous administration. Articles have been quoted saying that they seek a clean break from the previous administration and to invite members from industry who can better understand, in some of the quotes that I've seen, the impacts of regulations on the regulated community. I would only add to that that these science advisory boards are advising on scientific research, and we have no connection to the regulatory operations of the agency.
You're not forming policy here. You're just making sure that the science is sound.
Exactly.
That's Robert Richardson. He's an ecological economist at Michigan State University and now a former member of the Board of Scientific Counselors, which advises the U.S. EPA on pollution regulation and other matters. Thanks for taking the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. One of President Donald Trump's top goals is to repeal the Dodd-Frank financial regulations. He calls Dodd-Frank a disaster. Mr. Trump says many of his friends who have nice businesses can't get loans because of Dodd-Frank. There's no dispute about the fact that Dodd-Frank requires better lending standards after all the bad loans that pushed the nation toward recession. But banks are lending. The Federal Reserve finds commercial and industrial bank loans are at a record high. Michigan Congressman Bill Huizenga is the chair of the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets. He voted to advance the Financial Choice Act. That's legislation that would get rid of Dodd-Frank, and he joins us now. In an opinion piece published in the Holland Sentinel, you outlined some of the reasons you supported the legislation. Would you tell us why you think it's necessary?
First and foremost, Dodd-Frank has not done as had been advertised. Which is to make sure that we really got at the root cause of what happened to our economy. And it also, frankly, was an agenda waiting for a crisis to come along that went after a whole lot of other things that, frankly, had nothing to do with that crisis.
What kind of problem is it specifically causing your constituents?
We are seeing our small community banks, our regional banks, our credit unions. In fact, I'm on my way a little later today to meet with a group of credit union folks, and they will tell you repeatedly that Dodd-Frank has hurt their business, which ultimately hurts their local customers. It's very difficult to get a mortgage. It's very difficult to get a small business loan. We have seen the big banks get bigger, and virtually no new bank charters have happened. And in fact, we've seen our small community banks going the opposite direction and closing or consolidating.
By deregulating the financial industry, what are the chances that we'll eventually see the same kind of bank failures that triggered the Great Recession?
It's not that we are going to deregulate the banking system. We have overregulated. Ultimately, what we need to do is try to maintain those elements of Dodd-Frank that make sense in stabilizing the financial service space. But to jettison those other things. So, for example, the Securities and Exchange Commission is well outside the bounds of what it traditionally has done, which is supposed to make sure that we maintain market soundness, that investors are protected, and they really act as the police officers and maintaining those markets. Well, what we've got them doing now is more of a social agenda, and we're asking them to equivalent of asking our police officers to fill the potholes and make sure that the streetlights are working. Well, that's not their job. They're not good at that. They are good at other things, and let's get them focused back onto those things that they are good at to make sure that we maintain a steady, secure, and frankly safe environment for people to go out as consumers and for our businesses so that the way they can grow and we can make our economy respond much more quickly than what it has been in the marketplace that we've seen so far.
Part of the Financial Choice Act weakens the role of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That bureau is protecting people from bad actors in banking, credit cards, financial industry folks, and others. Why would you want to weaken it?
Because it's unconstitutional in its structure. That was what the recent court case had said. So we're not trying to pare back anybody's protections under the law. In fact, there are a myriad of other laws that are in place and other organizations and programs that are in place to protect those consumers. The CFPB originally was viewed as kind of a central gathering place. They have become a super regulator that has no direct funding from the government. It only goes through the Federal Reserve. Federal courts have said having the structure that it is, with a director that cannot be removed even by the president who appoints them for anything short of cause, is not a constitutional structure. So we have seen regulators out of control, frankly, through the CFPB.
So you're not eliminating a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You're just changing how it operates and who it responds to or who it's responsible to?
Most federal organizations like that operate with a board, either three people or five people. In this case, it's five that say, you know what, we're going to come up with consensus. It is made up of both Republicans and Democrats appointed. And not having just one person at the helm that is unanswerable to anybody. The other thing is we put it on budget. In other words, they have to come to Congress to receive their budget, much like the Securities and Exchange Commission or any of the other regulators have to do. And we think that those common sense elements really will help in its operation and that it's not going to just start making up rules, which is literally what it has done. It has fined people for actions that are currently legal, that they have been thinking about writing a rule on, and then they've gone back and retroactively said, you know what, we decided that we haven't liked what you've been doing, so we're going to fine you for the last 2 years, even though you haven't been breaking the law. That's fundamentally unfair.
Hasn't it also gotten tens of millions of dollars back to consumers who were cheated or, you know, taken advantage of by corporations?
Yeah, let's talk about how they've done that. So, for example, when they went in and had this fine against auto loans, they literally went through and tried to guess, because they're not allowed to ask the race of the people coming in for these loans. So they had to go in, the CFPB went in and guessed what names sounded like they might be ethnic names, what names sounded like they might be minority names. That ultimately is flawed right from the very beginning.
That's Congressman Bill Huizenga. He represents Michigan's 2nd District. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Hey, thanks, Lester. I appreciate it.
Later in the program, in a follow-up to Congressman Huizenga's comments, we'll hear from a Michigan professor who says that repealing and replacing banking regulations would be, quote, a horrible move. Plus, we'll talk about why Facebook founder and 32-year-old billionaire Mark Zuckerberg was hanging out on a Ford assembly line. That's in 10 minutes, here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Republicans and Democrats in Lansing support a big incentive package that big developers in the state want. These incentives not only include money for cleaning up polluted brownfield sites, but also getting income tax kickbacks from the workers who build the development and from the tax revenue that is made at the development. In a column published by The Week, Shuka Dalmia asks why Lansing would approve corporate welfare she says will only support billionaires. She joins us now. So the title of your piece is The Dark Side of Detroit's Renaissance. What is that dark side?
Well, the dark side, as you described, Lester, is some of the big business in Detroit. They are claiming the huge structures that they want to build are going to generate development for the city. And what they're really doing is using taxpayer money to line their own pockets. We have been promised this kind of development for decades in Detroit, and it's always the same story. We'll build casinos and we'll have development. We'll build stadiums and we'll have development. Now, the latest Detroit 2.0 model of that story is basically they are claiming that these sites, which is, you know, the old Hudson site, Dan Gilbert is saying he's going to build a 730-foot structure that is going to open up about $2 billion of growth for Detroit. Now, we've heard exactly those kinds of claims when, for instance, the Ford Field and Comerica Park were built, that it is going to open up all kinds of spillover development. None of that is happening. In this case, as you mentioned, what was most insidious about this particular bill that is being pushed in Lansing is it is not that Gilbert is going to the state authorities and saying, hey, you know, you've got this part of money for business redevelopment, give that to me. This is a whole new revenue stream that will go into his pocket before it even makes it into the state budget.
Many people think of Dan Gilbert as something of a folk hero. He's of Quicken Loans, of course. He's been bringing jobs to Detroit. He's been buying up vacant buildings and giving them new life. You apparently have a different perspective about Dan Gilbert. The project that prompted both of these attempts you just mentioned is the site where the Hudson Department Store once stood. The first attempt last year was a little too narrow because it was exclusively Detroit-centered on this brownfield bill. Now the legislators say, well, we want other cities to get a chance at this too. What's wrong with using taxpayer money to clean up a polluted or blighted site and then create something that could bring in some revenue to the state?
They have expanded this to a few other cities, and I think the bill says five cities.
Five.
And in each city, only one developer can qualify for this particular corporate welfare. And they have stipulated the criteria so closely that pretty much it's a foregone conclusion who's going to get it. The way this bill is written, in this case, only Dan Gilbert can qualify in Detroit because it requires a certain number of the developer's money to go into the project, in this case, $500 million, which sounds like a lot. And it has to be mixed use, which means that small developers who are, you know, building maybe just an office building or two or just an apartment building or two, because it's not mixed use, they cannot qualify. And that's the problem with it. It basically, instead of creating a level playing field where different businesses compete, basically the government is picking winners and losers and crafting a bill which is designed to put money into the pocket of one particular developer.
One conservative legislator who supported the legislation explained his vote by saying it's better to get half of something than 100% of nothing. In other words, the state will get some revenue with the development, but none without the development. So what do you think of that reasoning?
That's the reasoning that's always been made. And look, these calculations of what revenue the government is going to get are purely theoretical. We don't know if this is actually going to lead to the kind of growth that Gilbert and, you know, various other businesses are claiming we will get. What we do know is that they will get upfront a revenue stream, whereas other businesses that may be in the same area are going to be at a competitive disadvantage. And the problem with all of this is not just Gilbert is getting this money or other businesses are getting this kind of corporate welfare. I don't want to target Gilbert because he's putting in more of his own money than, say, Mike Ilitch was in the Red Wings Arena, which was almost purely corporate welfare. The problem with this is that it distorts the development priorities of the city. It starts tending to, you know, these few big developments. They suck up the resources of the city, leaving the rest of the city, you know, on its own.
Right. And you brought that up in your piece. And that's something we've talked about on this show a number of times. All this tax money being used to invest in developing downtown business districts while the neighborhoods where the citizens of Detroit live are not sharing in that prosperity. It's kind of like the trickle-down promise, but it hasn't done so far into the neighborhoods, even though downtown is booming. So is there a renaissance if the people who live in Detroit are excluded?
That's exactly the question. Now, the argument that they make is that once there is this, you know, development and growth in Detroit, it's going to spill over, which is a different version of trickle down, right? Spill over into the neighborhoods. And you see some growth. I mean, like the Eastern Market area is doing pretty well. But you know what? It was doing kind of well even before this whole renaissance started. What you are really seeing, actually, I mean, and this is still a little bit early, so this is not definitive, but Professor Laura Reese and her husband, Gary Sands, whom I quoted in the piece, they've actually started doing some research into the neighborhoods around the city. And what they are finding is that actually, on balance, those neighborhoods are still losing population. So Detroit's population, since the Renaissance began, has actually gone down. We won't know for sure till the next census is released. But so far, the indication is that still there is a population exodus. More importantly, businesses are still closing down. Smaller businesses, there's been a net decline in those businesses, about 13 zip codes that they just tabulated a few months ago. Instead of a spillover effect, what you're seeing is a suck-up effect. The downtown area is sucking up resources from the rest of the city and making the rest of the city perhaps even worse off.
So what's the big lesson to learn from what's happening here with this new incentive package that's been offered or will be offered? Are we going to walk away any smarter? I mean, you talked about stadiums. Across the nation, we hear this same promise of tax money goes into the stadium, we'll get a return on the tax money, and it almost never happens. It might happen more often when you're talking about a mixed-use retail apartment complex or something like that. But is there a lesson, a solid lesson we can take from the experiences we've had before?
Harvard University's Ed Glaser, he has written a lot about urban renewal projects. And, you know, one of the things he says is the reason cities go downhill is because because they end up having more infrastructure than they can actually sustain. In a city like Detroit, where you have 680,000 people right now, which is down from like 2 million at its peak, the city already had a problem with overbuilding. Buildings that were abandoned, they are too expensive to maintain and they are too expensive to tear down. Now what we are doing is cramming even more buildings in the hope that in some future age, more people are going to come in. And he has said that this is never a formula for development. What you need to do to develop is listen to the basics, improve the schools, good law and order situation, good infrastructure, provide the basics, and then let's see where development happens. One of the things, you know, that I mentioned in my piece was the light rail project. Now, that is going to be a source of huge thwarting of entrepreneurship in Detroit. If we actually had seen the kind of development that Gilbert is talking about, people pouring in, without the light rail, this could have been a huge source of opportunity for local Detroit residents. They could have started Uber services. They could have started Jitney services. They could have started all kinds of services that would have been a source of self-employment for local Detroiters to serve the people who are coming in. Now, even that opportunity is being taken away from them because there's this tiny light rail that will connect downtown to Midtown. And so the new hip people, young Detroiters who are in downtown, you know, they will have no need for those services. That's not how it happens in, you know, most big cities. My view is that private social engineering doesn't work necessarily better than government social engineering. Ultimately, it is dampening the little organic growth that is the lifeblood of most cities. New York is a great city because there are lots of avenues for self-employment for people. It's bustling with activity, right? I mean, and there are little mom-and-pop stores. And yes, you have the Rockefeller buildings and, you know, what have you. But there is so much other growth, organic activity going on that keeps the city alive. That's what we need first. The structures can come later. First, what you need to do is create an environment where the little guy can thrive, not the big developers.
Shekha Dalmia is with the Reason Foundation, a libertarian think tank. Her column in The Week is titled The Dark Side of Detroit's Renaissance. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Lester.
Opportunities.
Part of the community.
The next idea.
A culture for innovation is a culture with a sense of destiny, a sense of that tomorrow is going to be better than today. That's what the word progress means.
Facebook's 32-year-old billionaire founder Mark Zuckerberg has been touring the country. He made stops in Michigan recently. He toured Ford's Rouge plant, even tried his hand at putting on some parts on an F-150 pickup. Turns out time on the assembly line is kind of hard work. He also privately met with Muslim students at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The next idea is Jeff DeGraff and Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes join me. First, I want to ask each of you, Jeff, we'll start with you. What do you think is the reason behind this tour of 30 states?
I think he's trying to get a line of sight on autonomous vehicles. I think what he's trying to figure out is where are the metal benders going?
Well, you don't have to talk to Muslim students at U of M Dearborn or, you know, this Trump voting family in Ohio that was his next stop to find that out.
But you'll learn a lot about what people are thinking and what they're actually going to be using in the future. And it's pretty hard to see that from the West Coast.
Daniel, what do you think of his tour?
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting to read his posts on Facebook after he was here. I mean, he sounded a little wide-eyed, as if he'd kind of, for lack of a better term, was visiting the zoo. He goes into an auto plant and he's just slack-jawed that people actually work hard. I thought he came off as living in a bit of a bubble, and we here in Detroit know a little bit about living in a bubble. We've been accused of it, and rightly so, for many decades.
Yeah, the stop at the Ford Rouge plant is interesting. He also met with Bill Ford. He rode in one of Ford's autonomous vehicles. How much of this is just his curiosity? How much of it is research for future projects?
I think it's probably both. I don't think what I'm saying, what Jeff was saying, are in any way, shape, or form mutually exclusive. You know, one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years, I think, has been, I've been writing about a lot, this battle between Silicon Valley and Detroit, metaphorically Detroit, and it is a battle. There's no question about it. It is a competition. A few years ago, I think Silicon Valley had come to the conclusion that anybody can build a car or a truck or whatever the case may be, and has come to realize that that's not as easy as it looks, and some of these industries do have their own comparative advantage. There's really not a company out there that has got the market cornered on mobility and self-driving cars, and you're starting to see things break down into pockets of expertise or excellence. And when it comes to metal bending, I think Detroit and certainly the foreign manufacturers operating in the United States lead the way in building that stuff. So I think what you're seeing now is people trying to understand where the potential partnerships are, who the threats are, and where the opportunities are. The auto industry wants to get deeper into the business to basically save what it has and also to cut and improve its returns on investment. Tech industry is looking at this as the next new thing, and they're looking for growth, and this is a place to get it.
Yeah, I think the growth thing is the key. Yeah, let's put this in perspective for your listeners. If you took all of the big three and you added their market value, it's about $150 billion collectively. Facebook alone is $450 billion. And what Facebook has been doing in the past 2 or 3 years, they've been buying up every facial recognition company on the planet. They bought Oculus Rift, the big virtual reality company. They've bought, Wit AI, which is one of the big artificial intelligence. So what they're basically doing is making a huge play for the virtual experience, which is way more than social media. It's going to show up in cockpits and autonomous cars and what you do with your refrigerator. And the problem that they've got with that kind of valuation, now think about it for a minute. If you own a car company, you've got all kinds of legacy costs, overhead, labor. You've got all kinds of exposure legally. If you own a digital company, you have none of that. And it's all profitability. They're cash rich. What do you do with a lot of cash to grow a company that's worth way more than it's actually able to generate in revenue? And the answer is you start looking over the fence at companies that bend metal. Now, remember, we had one of these a few years back that didn't work at all. We had Google acquire Motorola. It was a terrible acquisition. They didn't know anything about creating phones. So that becomes the new question that I think Silicon Valley has learned from. What do we need to know that we don't know now about getting into these partnerships?
But, Jeff, are you suggesting that they are looking for a metal bending partner here or an acquisition? Seems to me that one of the things they've also learned is that the valuations of these companies are terrible, and you talked about it just a minute ago. I mean, you have a company like Tesla, which should deliver 25,000 vehicles in the first quarter, whose market value exceeds Ford Motor Company's and, depending on the day, exceeds General Motors as well. And that company was losing $13,200 on each vehicle it produced in the first quarter.
I'm not saying they should acquire them. I'm saying they want a line of sight. I want you to think back about 15 years when Amazon lost money for 10 years in a row. It was the same argument people made. There's no retail market here. You're losing money. And Amazon last year constituted 55% of all retail on the web and 50% of all growth. So the problem with growth stocks is they're what's called convex economics, which means they lag way below. They lose money for some period of time. And most of them never make money. This is Daniel's point. Most of them don't. But when they do, and they've been able to create a footprint for, let's say, 10 years like Facebook has, all of a sudden, there's a lot of upside. So I don't think it's that they want to bend metal. I think what he's trying to learn is what he doesn't know now about the people bend metal so that when they make those partnerships, they're more informed. At least that's my take on it.
And for that, I would give the guy a lot of credit. And secondarily, as I said in the column I wrote on this and also the commentary I did over the weekend, I give him credit for coming out here and doing this kind of stuff and trying to understand. Covering this industry in a lot of stress over the last decade, one of the things that has both impressed me and infuriated me has been a lot of people, and I'm generalizing here, on the coast who kind of look down on what they do here and really don't understand how this industry has transformed itself, both by its own initiative and also because it was forced to, particularly in 2008 and 2009.
Couldn't agree more. Cars, I think, are way more sophisticated. And we shouldn't even call them cars. It's the transportation industry now. I think there's another game here, though, that people are overlooking. And the game is they're really not playing for cars or they're not playing for this experience. They're playing for data. And the issue is we're now in an economy where we can actually begin to predict what are called heuristics, what people are thinking, what they're likely to buy. And those things become invaluable. Now, there are moral questions around that. There's a lot of moral questions. You can lead into redlining and all kinds of stuff. And there are cases around the world where that's happened, of course. But you just have to understand what the vector of a company that's really outgrown the sector that it's in, it really needs to find something else to eat in order to continue to grow.
All right. We've got time enough for one more question, and I want to get this one in. What do you think he's really going to accomplish by this tour? I mean, is it going to be life-changing for him, or would he be better off hiring the right consultants?
I think it's going to make him smarter, and I think that's the whole point. Toyota Motor Corporation has got a phrase called go and see, and it's been part of the way they've managed the company for decades. And basically what it meant is executives need to go to countries and they need to see how things operate and how other competitors operate. And I think that's what he's doing here. And I give him credit, but I also think we'll find out what he uses with that information.
Yeah, I think there's something similar. I mean, when I meet people around the world and I say, well, I'm from an area near Detroit, you know, they usually grimace. And I'll say, get on a plane and go. It's very different than what you think it is. And I think that's what he did. He got on a plane and went because Detroit is happening. And he went and said, oh, my gosh, there's a lot of things happening here. And remember, when it comes to power generation, which other than data and other than healthcare is the next huge area, that is something that Detroit is uniquely capable at. And somebody who's looking to grow a business, I think if they're looking for what the next big growth opportunity, which is, according to most industry reports, north of $10 trillion, I think it's power generation. I think he'd be a fool not to come and look at it.
Well, I appreciate talking to both of you guys. It's the easiest interview I've ever done because all I had to do is kickstart it, and you guys took off. Next time we have beer when we do it, okay?
Thanks.
That's Jeff DeGraff. He is a clinical professor of business administration at the Ross School of Business and University of Michigan. Daniel Howes is business columnist for the Detroit News and a contributor to Michigan Radio. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan Radio's Rick Pluta recently reported on the state Supreme Court agreeing to hear arguments about whether indigent defendants have the right to their own court-appointed experts. In this case, the defendant wanted a DNA expert.
DNA evidence was the key to convicting Johnny Ray Kennedy of a 20-year-old murder. Kennedy's DNA was in a state repository because he was already convicted of two other murders. Kennedy asked for a court-appointed DNA expert to be part of his legal team to help with the cross-examination of the state's DNA expert. The judge said no, that it was up to Kennedy's defense lawyer to uncover holes in the state's case. The Michigan Supreme Court is asking both sides to argue whether the judge's decision violated Kennedy's constitutional right to due process.
These kinds of questions get to the heart of the mission of the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission. Its purpose is to work to ensure the state's public defense system is fair, cost-effective, and constitutional. Thomas Boyd is a 55th District Court judge and a member of the commission, and he joins us now. Interesting question. How fair and cost-effective is it for an indigent defendant to get an expert witness paid for by taxpayer dollars?
Well, Lester, let me just say at the outset that I'm not really going to be commenting on that case that's before the Supreme Court for lots of reasons I'm sure you can understand. But I want to convey to you and to your audience that the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission was created to establish minimum standards for every indigent defense system. So that's every county and every town in the state should have a system that provides constitutionally effective defense to people who can't afford their own lawyer. What we mean by constitutionally effective defense is spelled out through various court cases, United States Supreme Court cases. In specific response to your question, I can tell you that the first four minimum standards recommended by the Indigent Defense Commission include access to investigators and experts. So every local system, every county, every city that has a court would need to establish a plan that includes how they're going to make available experts to defendants. So it's very reasonable to require it. And moving forward, each local indigent criminal defense system will need to provide a plan that does provide independent experts and investigators to criminal defendants.
Well, let's talk about the practicalities just for a second, because in some cases you could see the expert witness list and cost go up dramatically. And not all counties have enough money to pay for public defense now. How would that be accomplished?
Two really important points. First, all increased expenditures as a result of meeting minimum standards will be paid for by the state. The counties are going to have to meet the same payment level, the same expenditure level they were paying the average of the 3 years prior to 2013 when the Indigent Defense Commission was created. So there won't be any additional local spending. The second is the United States Supreme Court has articulated this rule in terms of reasonableness. So, for instance, in 1984, in Strickland versus Washington, the United States Supreme Court said that counsel has a duty to make reasonable investigations or to make a reasonable decision that makes a particular investigation unnecessary. So it's not every investigator, every expert, chase every, you know, stray dog to its home. It's a reasonable determination of what investigations need to be made and don't need to be made, and every local system has to provide a plan which will do that in every case.
Let's get an update. We've talked before about the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission's work and their advice to the legislature. Have we seen any of the recommendations that the commission has made embraced by the legislature at this point? And where do you go after the first four items are taken care of?
We had a little bit of a hiccup. The original Indigent Defense Commission Act of 2013 called for the Michigan Supreme Court to review the rules and then pass on their constitutionality effectively. When that was asked of the court early last year, the court basically pointed out some constitutional defects in that approach. The order from the Supreme Court pointing out these constitutional defects asked the legislature to fix the defects and change the approval process for the minimum standards. The legislature did that at the close of 2016. So where we are now is under that amended act. These first four minimum standards have been submitted to the director of the Michigan State Department of Licensing Regulatory Affairs. She has them now, and actually we anticipate fairly soon we'll be approving those standards. Once she approves them, every local system has 180 days to develop a plan which complies with those minimum standards.
So this is going forward even with that hiccup. You've made good progress, it sounds like.
We have, and honestly, the court was right. We had just never looked at it from their perspective. The legislature acted promptly to fix the problem, and we're back in business again. The answer to your second question is the Indigent Defense Commission, just within the last 30 days, issued three more minimum standards for public comment.
Can you give us a quick description of those three minimum standards?
The three standards just suggested by the Indigent Defense Commission are independence from the judiciary, workload, and qualifications. The first means that it shouldn't be the court that determines how far a defense can go in one direction or another. The court literally should be the official in the playing field, not approving the budget of one of the combatants in the field. Workload just means, as the United States Supreme Court said in Strickland, the mere presence of a lawyer at trial is not enough to satisfy the constitutional commands. So you have to have a lawyer who has the time and, seventh standard closely related, the qualifications, the experience, to actually defend that defendant in that case. So with these three additional standards, the Indigent Defense Commission is asking local systems to, you know, really intensify the supervision and the product, the talents of the lawyers assigned to indigent defendants to assure constitutionally competent counsel.
The state is going to have to pay for this additional cost. Is there any indication that there's the mood in the legislature to, you know, include that in appropriations or the budget this year?
Well, you know, we look back at when Public Act 93 of 2013 that created the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission was passed. It was something like 106-0 in the Michigan House. And it included the fact that new spending would be necessary. New spending would be paid for by the state legislature. Obviously, the devil's in the details. And when they're looking at real dollars and real plans to implement these minimum standards, I'm sure there'll be tough questions and perhaps some dissent. However, if you look at the political spectrum, both on the right and the left, people believe that the constitutional rights need to be protected. People believe in the right to a fair trial. People believe in convicting the guilty party, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because if they convict someone who's not guilty, the guilty party's still out there. So not only is it a constitutional imperative, but it's the right thing to do from both a moral and a fiscal perspective.
That's Judge Thomas Boyd. He's a member of the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission. Thanks for talking with us.
Anytime, Lester. Thank you.
Earlier in the show, we heard from Michigan Congressman Bill Huizenga, who wants to get rid of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. University of Michigan professor Michael Barr was one of the lead figures in drafting and negotiating Dodd-Frank. Barr testified before Congress last month about a proposed law, the Financial Choice Act, that would dismantle Dodd-Frank. CHOICE stands for Creating Hope and Opportunity for Investors, Consumers, and Entrepreneurs. Just last week, the bill moved out of the House Committee on Financial Services. Now Professor Barr joins us. The Obama administration suggested a package of bills. Revised versions were introduced by Senator Chris Dodd and Representative Barney Frank. So that's why it's called Dodd-Frank. What was your role?
Well, I served as the Treasury point person on the bill. So I was responsible for drafting the legislation from the Treasury perspective, coming up with policies, and then negotiating with the committees, relevant committees in both the House and the Senate to get it passed.
I want to talk about Dodd-Frank a little later, but let's talk about this choice bill that's being introduced to replace it. During your testimony before Congress, you stated that the draft legislation, the Financial Choice Act as written, has a lot of flaws, but you narrowed it down to three key problems. Let's talk about the first one you identified, and that's weakening oversight of the financial system. Why do you say that that would happen with this draft legislation?
Well, the Choice Act would roll back many of the key measures put in place in Dodd-Frank and even before that to strengthen the safety and soundness of the financial system. It would make it impossible to regulate firms like Lehman Brothers and AIG that weren't organized as a bank but caused many of the problems in the financial crisis. It would eliminate the ability of the Federal Reserve to have heightened standards for these biggest firms. If they hit a certain capital percentage, they would be able to opt out of all kinds of provisions like stress testing to make sure that big financial institutions could withstand a financial downturn. So there's a whole bunch of measures taken in this act, weakening of the Volcker Rule, which pushed proprietary trading out of bank holding companies, weakening the Federal Reserve's ability to supervise the largest banks, and rolling back and eliminating the ability to supervise these firms like Lehman and AIG that organize themselves in a different way.
Your second point was that this would eliminate the orderly liquidation. In other words, we couldn't shut down these banks that, you know, might be too big to fail, but we needed to make sure they got rid of them. We did get rid of a couple of firms.
That's right. And the orderly liquidation authority gives the government the ability to wind down a firm like Lehman or AIG without causing a financial panic. It's designed to prevent the kind of bailouts that happen in the crisis. It's designed to prevent the kind of disorderly failure like Lehman that happened in the crisis. So it's a really essential tool for tackling this problem of too big to fail. And the Financial Choice Act would repeal it. It would get rid of it entirely.
The third point you make is this would undermine consumer and investor protections. In what way?
The bill would really cripple the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is the bureau that was set up in the wake of the financial crisis to look out for the interests of American families, to take on problems in debt collection and credit cards and prepaid cards, problems really across the sector with the way that financial institutions were treating service members and older Americans. And what this bill does is cripple it. It takes away its authority to supervise banks. It cuts back on its ability to go after unfair and deceptive acts and practices. It blocks a lot of rule writing on things like payday lending. So it is really just a horrible move on the part of this Congress.
Now, this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that you're talking about, the Republican members of Congress really want to end that. In fact, Representative Jeb Hensarling of Texas wants to do away with the director as well. He wants to make sure that that's an appointed position by the president and not somebody who's in there for a while. That is currently held by Richard Cordray. What's behind that? Why are they so determined to get rid of this bureau that's supposed to protect us?
I think that it's really just an ideological move. They're upset that Consumer Agency has been so effective. It's returned nearly $12 billion in relief to 29 million American families across the country. And I think that's gotten under their skin. I think they and some in the financial industry are really ganging up on the agency. I think it would be bad for American families.
One of the members of Congress who backs the Financial Choice Act is Representative Bill Huizenga. That's important because he happens to be a chair of a financial services subcommittee. He wrote in an opinion piece that Dodd-Frank did not end the notion that certain banks are too big to fail. Instead, Dodd-Frank enshrined it, that taxpayers continue to be on the hook for Wall Street's poor business decisions thanks to the Dodd-Frank bailout fund. How much truth is there in that?
It's completely backwards. Basically, the approach they're taking is says, let's turn a blind eye to risks in the financial system. Let's pretend that firms like Lehman or Citigroup or AIG can't cause problems in the future. And we're going to wave a magic wand and say no more bailouts. That doesn't make any sense. Instead, what Dodd-Frank put in is heightened capital and prudential requirements for the biggest firms. It put in place an orderly liquidation authority to wind down that firm without a financial panic. It regulated shadow banking and derivatives. And this is really all being put at risk by this new Financial Choice Act and the Trump administration.
I want to get to a couple of more points that Representative Huizenga said, but I heard former Representative Barney Frank, one of the authors of Dodd-Frank, concede that there were some problems with the act. But rather than scrapping it, he told NPR it simply needs some tweaks. What are some of the problems and what kind of tweaks might fix it?
Well, I agree. I don't think any legislation is perfect. Washington, D.C. is not a 100% kind of town. It's a town where you have to make compromises and adjustments, and mistakes obviously get introduced into the drafting process. And as someone intimately involved in it, I can tell you there are problems, you know, throughout the act that I would like to see fixed, but they really are in the nature of tweaks. They're corrections, they're simplifications. I think it would be good, for example, to clarify that some provisions don't apply to the very smallest community banks. There's no reason that a community bank needs to spend any money showing that they don't need to comply with the Volcker Rule. We should just say that up front. But the bill that's being considered has nothing to do with that. It's not a community banking bill. It's a bill that really helps the largest banks escape tough new regulation.
Well, that's one of the things that Representative Huizenga brings up, that the largest banks are even bigger now and the small banks are fewer because they've been dealing with Dodd-Frank and it's just too much for them, too much of a burden to comply with the regulations that were intended for these bigger banks. That's a fair point, you think, then?
I don't think so. I think if you look at the community banking system as a whole, I think it's an essential part of our financial system. We have a diverse and really quite powerful and strong community banking system. If you look at the most recent figures from 2016, community banks are increasing their small business lending faster than the big banks.
Well, that's
their
been the
revenue
big complaint
is higher
for a while now, that a lot of small businesses say, I can't get a loan at my bank because of all these regulations. That's not the case?
I think it is too hard for small businesses to get loans. I've written a lot about that in my research, but it's really not about the Dodd-Frank Act. It really is fundamentally, we need to have a strong system for supporting community banking, for supporting small banking. And I think we have that. We can do tweaks in the Dodd-Frank Act to make it better, but none of that is what's being considered on Capitol Hill right now. It really is a bill that's aimed at easing the restrictions on the largest firms in the country.
I'll make one final point that Representative Huizenga says, and that's through Dodd-Frank, this red tape, this regulatory cost, a lot of it's being passed on to consumers in the form of increased fees, fewer products and services, more limited credit options. You don't think that's the case?
I don't. If you look at the real harm caused to the American economy, if you look at the real harm caused to American households, it was from the devastating financial crisis that came from not having tough oversight of the largest firms. If you look today across the market, there is access to capital, there is access to credit. There can always be more, but it's not being driven by the Dodd-Frank Act. It really needs to be driven by a recovery from the financial crisis that devastated American families.
So is this Financial Choice Act a matter of Republicans saying, look, we don't want government interfering with business at all if we can avoid it, and this is a step back from what was too much regulatory authority through Dodd-Frank? Is that what we're looking at?
I think we always go through cycles of regulation where there's less or more of it. I think the thing I'm really worried about now is there's kind of a collective amnesia descending on Washington, where politicians are forgetting the enormous harm caused by the financial crisis to American families. I don't think those families have forgotten that pain, but I'm worried that these politicians have.
Michael Barr is a professor at the law school at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ali Billings and engineered by Bob Scott. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Lise Mesmer. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.